is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyis Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We see prospects for recovery that are strengthening as countries deploy measures to contain pandemic new waves, but also implement efforts to roll out vaccine at a higher speed.
That was Albert G. Zafak, the World Bank's chief economist for Africa, on the prospects for growth in sub-Saharan Africa despite the impact of COVID-19. Details are coming up. Also, a UN report says 11,000 people have fled from the Mozambique town of Palma after jihadists attacked 2 weeks ago. And the retired Archbishop of South Sudan, Paulino Lukudu Loro, died yesterday at age 80. All these and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. The U.S. government recently designated the Islamic State allied militants in northern Mozambique as a foreign terrorist organization, or FTO. The move allows several U.S. agencies to pursue members of the group in various ways. The insurgents have been launching attacks in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province since late 2017. The United Nations estimates around 2,000 people have been killed so far, with 700,000 displaced. Darren Taylor has more.
Washington's declaration of the Mozambican group, which calls itself several names, including Al-Shabaab, as an FTO, allows the U.S. Treasury to seize its assets held in American financial institutions. On the surface, says Emilia Colombo, of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., the move won't have a big impact on the terrorists' day-to-day operations. It's not likely they have money in U.S. bank accounts, for example.
They seem to rely to some degree on the illicit economy in the area. Any sort of proceeds they may earn from that is unlikely to turn up in an easy place for U.S. law enforcement to find. We still see them relying extensively on looting, which, again, like, that's not something that U.S. law enforcement can easily track down and seize or freeze.
But, adds the former senior analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, the FTO designation gives authority to the U.S. Department of Justice to investigate, arrest, and prosecute anyone deemed to have provided material support to the militants.
This is an organization that's largely confined to a tiny corner of Mozambique, maybe a little bit of spillover into East Africa. It's still not an area where it'll be easy to track down individuals and build a case to then arrest them.
South Africa's Institute for Security Studies says the Mozambican insurgents are backed by similar groups in various parts of Africa, with fighters, weapons, ammunition, and perhaps other resources.
The penalty for providing material support to an FTO is anywhere between 15 and 20 years to life in prison, along with civil penalties, fines, asset seizures, and things like this. So again, this provision is more effective in areas where the U.S. has a good relationship with host governments.
Colombo says the definition of material support is very broad.
There have been instances of people who were by circumstance forced into cooking, cleaning, providing auto repair services for an organization, and then applied for asylum and were declared ineligible. There is an appeal process.
She foresees the U.S. becoming involved in humanitarian efforts in Cabo Delgado, but she adds, even on a good day, this is hard due to poor infrastructure, regular bad weather, bureaucratic red tape, and a multitude of armed groups. Colombo says the FTO designation complicates an already difficult situation.
What happens when a humanitarian organization needs to negotiate with the FTO for the safe passage of their goods and their people? What happens when they need to provide aid to an individual that may or may not have some connection to the organization? How do they treat people that we've seen recently be released from the group who were forced to provide cooking and cleaning and some kind of service? How do you provide aid to them when, in theory, you're providing material support to the group?
She warns the FTO declaration could also complicate the eventual ending of the conflict.
Even in this context of peace or movement towards peace, they are still an FTO. If somebody needs a ride to the negotiations, who's going to provide that transport? Because you're still lending material aid to the group. How do you help set up, demobilization camps, provide food, provide medicine, because that is still providing aid to the FTO?
Colombo believes it's going to take years to solve the crisis in Cabo Delgado. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The United Nations reports more than 11,000 people have fled the coastal town of Palma in northern Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province since jihadist insurgents attacked the town nearly 2 weeks ago. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Civilians arriving in Pemba, the capital of Mozambique's Cabo Delgado, are telling aid workers that thousands of people are trapped inside Palma and the surrounding area. They also report that people fleeing Mozambique have been refused entry into nearby Tanzania. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Baba Baluch says it is very worrisome that people fleeing for their lives are being prevented from seeking asylum.
More than 1,000 tried to cross into Tanzania, tried to cross the border from Mozambique into Tanzania, and they were turned back. So at this stage, we don't know how this happened, who did this, but we are trying to seek clarification from the authorities on the other side inside Tanzania.
The UNHCR is appealing to Mozambique's neighbors to allow entry to people escaping violence and seeking protection. Dozens of people reportedly were killed by Islamist militants who attacked Palma on March 24th. Thousands of people have been displaced, and the economic fallout from the onslaught is potentially huge. The French energy giant Total has suspended its multi-million-dollar liquefied natural gas project in the area. Baloch says his agency and others are scaling up relief efforts for the thousands of destitute, deeply distressed survivors of the attacks in Palma.
The majority of new arrivals are women and children who are coming with few belongings, most showing signs of severe trauma following the atrocities they witnessed and are worried for those relatives who were left behind. The sudden and deadly nature of the attacks have left families torn apart, many still unable to leave.
Baluch notes many children are unaccompanied when they arrive. He says efforts are being made to trace and reunite them with their families. Baluch adds the needs are immense. They range from basic relief, including food, water, health care, and shelter, to psychological counseling and protection from gender-based violence and sexual exploitation. The UNHCR warns it will be unable to properly assist the displaced without more generous support from donors. It recently appealed for $19.2 million to help Cabo Delgado. To date, the agency says less than 40% of that has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The retired Catholic Archbishop of South Sudan, Paulino Lukudu Loro, died in Nairobi yesterday at the age of 80. He served for 30 years and was hailed by many in South Sudan for his efforts to promote peace during the country's long civil war. Winnie Sirino reports from Juba.
The Reverend Father Samuel Abe, spokesperson for the Catholic Archdiocese of Juba, said Archbishop Loro was rushed to Kenya's capital last month when his condition started deteriorating.
First of all, last Saturday he had a very, very severe stroke which affected his brain, and so this escalated into instability of his blood pressure, and today the pressure just went down, and I think it's the cause of it. Primarily the stroke on his head.
Abe said Loro's death has left a great void because he was a key player in advising political leaders on how to achieve peace in South Sudan.
Well, it is very clear as a peacemaker, a man of peace, he always advises people to take the interests of the country above our personal and our individual interests. And so his words are still, I think, in our minds. His words are still with us. And it is up to us to put all these endeavors, these initiatives into practice, especially the political leaders, religious leaders of this country.
Abe said he wished Laura had witnessed peace in South Sudan before his death, but noted that people are still fighting and still dying. Ellie Joseph, youth chairperson at St. Kizito Parish, said Laura played a significant peacemaking role among various factions during the years when South Sudan was fighting for its independence from Sudan. During South Sudan's more recent civil war, Simon Gore, youth coordinator at St. Theresa Cathedral, said he remembers Bishop Laura for his boldness in telling the truth to the warring leaders.
The peace process, he was not favoring any side. When he felt that there is slowness in implementation, he approached both of the partners and air out his voice and the right thing that they should supposed to be doing in order for his flocks not to suffer.
Laura was appointed Archbishop of Juba on February 19, 1983, and served in his office until his retirement last year. Archbishop Stephen Ameyu announced a four-day mourning period due to Laura's death. It is not clear when Laura will be buried. Winnie Sereno for VOA News, Juba.
The World Bank says economic growth in sub-Saharan Africa contracted by 2% last year, but prospects for recovery are strengthening despite new waves of COVID-19. From the Kenyan capital Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
The World Bank's biannual economic analysis for Africa says a slower spread of the coronavirus, strong agricultural growth, and a faster-than-expected recovery in commodity prices have helped many African economies weather the economic storm induced by the pandemic. Albert Zoufak is the World Bank chief economist for Africa.
We do see sub-Saharan Africa poised for recovery. We see prospects for recovery that are strengthening as countries deploy measures to contain pandemic new waves, but also implement efforts to roll out vaccine at a higher speed.
The report, titled The Future of Work in Africa, Emerging Trends in Digital Technology Adoption, notes that economic recovery hinges on countries deepening reforms that create jobs, encourage investment, and enhance competitiveness. The resurgence of the pandemic in late 2020, with daily infections about 40% higher than during the first wave, and limited additional fiscal support, will pose an uphill battle as policymakers pursue stronger growth and improved livelihoods for their people. But sub-Saharan Africa's recovery is expected to vary across countries, as the senior World Bank economist explains.
The good news is our three largest economies will be back to positive growth in 2021, but it's still going to be quite a low growth, around 1.4% in Nigeria, 0.9% in Angola. South Africa could grow at maybe 3%, but the rest of Africa is actually growing faster. There is also a clear rebound in consumption and investment as confidence comes back to countries that have managed to contain the virus.
Non-resource-intensive countries such as Cote d'Ivoire and Kenya and mining-dependent economies such as Botswana and Guinea are expected to see robust growth this year, driven by a rebound in private consumption and investment as confidence strengthens and exports increase. The new report also notes that African countries can speed up their recovery by ramping up existing support efforts, especially for women, youth, and other vulnerable groups. Zoufak says the deepening debt crisis is a growing concern.
Our countries have been piling up debt at a very fast pace, and that debt was not only riskier, but costlier. So when the pandemic hit and commodity prices collapsed, the debt situation became even more serious. The number of African countries that are at high risk of debt distress has increased significantly. Basically, a country like Zambia not being able to service its debt.
Reducing debt burdens will release resources for public investment in areas such as education, health, and infrastructure. Additionally, reforms that address digital infrastructure gaps and make the digital economy more inclusive, ensuring affordability, but also building skills for all segments of society, are essential to improve connectivity and generate more and better jobs. Zelfak gives more details.
What is absolutely clear is that Africa has not wasted the opportunity of this crisis. More people in Africa are using e-commerce. Just as an example, the volume of transaction on Jumia has more than doubled in the first 6 months of 2020. That's Africans using e-commerce more aggressively.
The next 12 months will be critical for leveraging the African Continental Free Trade Area to deepen African countries' integration into regional and global value chains. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The United Nations Resident Coordinator and Humanitarian Coordinator in Libya, Georgette Gagnon, says mine clearing operations have removed 7.5 tons of explosives from 120 kilometers of the main west-east coastal road. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed with Wolfgang Poshtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, how would that impact reopening the road, which is one of the conditions of the ceasefire reached in October?
Clearing the whole road and its immediate surrounding from mines and unexploded ordnance is certainly a preconditioning for opening the coastal road. The opening depends now only on the will of the militias and the military forces deployed and blocking the road. This would be not only a very symbolic move for the whole progress achieved so far, but it would be also of practical use for the people living in this area along the coast from Misrata to Ajdabiya, as they use mainly the road for communication and for commuting. But for the leadership on both sides, it is not that easy. They can't just give an order, because especially the Islamist militias on both sides operate quite independent from the military leaderships. So there is no real centralized control. And for example, the Misrata militias have already demanded their outstanding payments before they would agree to open the road.
Would the UN enhance the ceasefire with UN observers backed by NATO or European Union observers?
Talks are currently about a civilian-only mission. It would not be a problem for the United Nations to recruit even a couple of hundred civilian observers. They are very professional in this. But the efficiency of such a mission depends not only on manpower and mobility, but also on sophisticated surveillance equipment, for example, radar equipment, electronic intelligence, satellite reconnaissance, and so on. NATO would be certainly in a position to provide this, using the means of its member states, especially the United States. But as Turkey is also a NATO member and one of the warring factions, it is unlikely that UN will ask NATO for support. As an alternative, the European Union could provide almost the same as NATO. I underline almost the same as NATO for this case. However, it is still far from sure that the Libyans would accept such a mission, as the efficiency of a civilian observer mission is not really in the interest of everyone, especially those who have still a military option in mind, like the former Operation Volcano and its Turkish supporters, are quite hesitant. There was no statement from this side at all for the time being. Such a mission would certainly severely limit their military options. While on the other side, Khalifa Haftar's Libyan National Army has no possibility to resume any offensive operations in the near future anyway. They are simply too weak for this.
The withdrawal of foreign fighters and mercenaries is delayed for about 3 months beyond the original deadline. Several calls for their pullout went unanswered. What's the way out?
It is necessary to be realistic about the prospects right now. The final decision about such a withdrawal of the Turks and of the Russians is not made in Libya. This is not in the hands of Libyan politicians or warlords or military persons, but ultimately in Ankara and in Moscow and in the Emirates. And the withdrawal of the Turks and the Russians is also tied to each other. It is unrealistic that one side will leave and the other stay. This was underlined by the head of the High Council of State, Khalid al-Mishri, who mentioned recently during a meeting with the French foreign minister Le Drian that the withdrawal of troops invited by the legitimate government, he was referring to the Turks, could only take place after the withdrawal of all the others. So international pressure is required, especially from the United States on Turkey and on the Emirates. A realistic sequence of events could be at first the establishment of a credible UN monitoring mission to be sure to be able to identify who is violating the ceasefire, and thereafter a step-by-step withdrawal of both Russians and Turks until they have withdrawn all their forces from Libya. A very positive gesture of goodwill would be now the withdrawal of the other mercenaries, the Syrians on the side in the west, paid by the Turks and the Qataris, and the Sudanese, paid probably by the Emirates, on the side of the LNA.
That was Wolfgang Porstai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Tanzania's new president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, says the country will begin following scientific procedures in handling COVID-19 after denials about the spread of the coronavirus under her late predecessor, John Magufuli. In a speech today, Hassan says media houses that were banned or punished under Magufuli will reopen. The promise to return several Benin bronzes from three Western institutions to the former kingdom of Benin in Nigeria was celebrated by many. But returning all the artifacts looted by British soldiers 125 years ago will continue to be a challenge. Martha van der Wolf reports from London.
In recent weeks, a university in Scotland and museums in Germany and Britain pledged to repatriate the Benin bronzes they own. The restitution is hugely symbolic to Timothy Awoyemi, a British-born Nigerian who helped repatriate two Benin bronzes in 2014 from a private collector whose grandfather had been part of the 19th century looting. Awoyemi says he was elated when he heard about the latest returns.
They stole it, so it makes me happy because the stolen artifacts are going to be returned back to where they rightly belong.
British soldiers looted the Kingdom of Benin in what is currently Edo State in Nigeria during a punitive military expedition in 1897. The high-valued plaques, masks, and sculptures functioned as an historical archive to the Benin Royal Palace. The sculptures made of brass, bronze, and ivory are now owned and displayed across Western museums and institutions. Oxford professor Dan Hicks is the curator of the Pitt River Museum, which holds 145 Benin objects. He authored a book about the bronzes and says the displays of stolen art in Western museums continues to hurt people in the present.
The dispossession of art and culture was a central sort of part of how military operations that sought to remove sovereignty and sought to destroy traditional religion and sought to remove identity, you know, culture. That was a central part of what the Europeans were doing in the 1880s, 1890s, you know, across Africa.
Hicks says the argument that Western museums would be emptied out or shut down is unlikely, as restitution needs a case-by-case approach. Thousands of bronzes from the former Benin Empire are held in private collections and in over 160 museums around the world. Most have offered to discuss loaning the bronzes instead of repatriation. The British Museum in London holds about 900 Benin objects, the largest collection in the world. Its website reads no formal written request has been received for the return of the entire Benin collection, despite the bronzes being filed under contested objects. Additionally, laws would need to be changed because British national collections are prohibited from giving away their collection. The African Foundation for Development, AFFORD, is a British-based charity which for the past year has investigated the challenges and obstacles related to returning African artifacts. Executive Director Onyekachu Wambu says that even if the national collections aren't willing or able to repatriate, there are many more places and people owning Benin bronzes.
There are lots of different museums around the country which have their own collections and they're not covered by the law. There are others that are in private collections and those are going to be much more difficult to do and because, you know, those people sometimes don't want to do it.
It's said over 90% of African cultural legacy is held outside the continent. Although many Western countries have laws ensuring the return of Nazi-looted art, this approach has not been extended when it comes to art stolen from Africa and other parts of the world. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for